Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Imperfect Leaders. If you like today's show, please consider sharing us with your friends. Until then, sit back and enjoy today's episode. Today's guest, Jeff Smart, literally wrote the book that has redefined the way companies think about talent and leadership. Actually, he's written many best-selling books on the topic. Jeff's a true pioneer, a thought leader, and a business leader who comes from very humble beginnings. A long time ago, while working for the iconic management professor and thought leader Peter Drucker, Jeff had a brilliant idea. Why not apply a much more rigorous and data-driven approach to help companies evaluate high-potential talent and new hires? Since then, Jeff has literally revolutionized how companies, boards, and investors assess culture fit and leadership potential. The company he founded, GH Smart, is widely recognized as the industry leader. So, if you've ever wondered what goes on behind closed doors after a big interview, when the key assessors and gatekeepers are separating the good talent, who probably won't get the job, from the great ones, who definitely do get the jobs, I would pay very close attention to Jeff's advice. Your entire career might depend on it. So GH Smart, a company you founded, helps companies solve their most important and most complex leadership challenges. This is a company that's loved by clients and consistently ranked as one of the most prestigious and most innovative consulting boutiques in the world. So tell us a little bit about GH Smart and tell us some of the ways you help clients solve these incredibly difficult leadership challenges.
Sure. All right. Well, we had very humble beginnings. Peter Drucker, you know, the great management, you know, thought leader, godfather of the whole field, was a professor of mine out at Claremont in Los Angeles, where I actually wrote the business plan for GH Smart. And his initial reaction was as follows. He said, it's clear you know nothing. You know nobody. You have no money. So, you know, good luck with this business.
That sounds like, from what I've heard about the famous iconic Peter Drucker, it sounds exactly like what he would say.
Yeah, that's funny. So I was pretty convinced that the kernel of the idea for GH Smart had merit, which was this. A couple of years prior, I had worked at a venture capital firm and listened to these seasoned pros tell me over and over again that they made money or lost money based mostly not on what they invested in, but who they invested in. You know, you used to work in search, like, so, you know, you had search firms that source candidates, you have law firms, you had, you know, McKinsey, Bain, and BCG doing kind of market studies for the private equity industry. You have lawyers, of course, you have all these advisors, but there wasn't like the clear top firm doing assessments and coaching and development of talent in that space. And so that was the pitch to Peter Drucker, was, what, you know, why shouldn't there be a McKinsey of management assessment and coaching, et cetera. And he said, you know, that he was teasing me a bit on, like, I know nothing. And he was right. This is an Imperfect Leaders podcast, right? So how about this for an imperfect beginning? I had never had a real job. I sold newspaper subscriptions out of grocery stores in high school. You know, I actually worked during college part-time as a recruitment professional. So I had like a little bit of a dabble in the talent space. But this is basically listening to the private equity industry tell me, hey, look, you can never get a real handle on people. The human part is squishy. You know, although there are disciplined processes for collecting data on, you know, markets and products and financials, you know, you just have to use your gut when you're, you know, encountering people, and there's nothing you can do about it. So I questioned that assumption, and that was half the reason I founded the firm. Was I just, the theory was fact-based, evidence-based decision-making around people issues could yield a useful service.
Interesting. So you had a gut feel right away that it wasn't good for companies to make decisions based on their gut when it comes to people. So what were some of the things that you know, when you first got started, what were some of the ways that you help clients? And actually, what are some of the ways you help them now?
It's basically a whole lot of putting method to the madness of helping people who run or own large companies to make better people decisions. So mm-hmm. It's a lot of fun. We have mm-hmm. some competition, but not much. And we're having a blast building this impossible business, if you ask Peter Drucker 28 years ago.
So when I hear Succession, you know, I think about HBO Succession on TV, and
that's probably one of the most popular shows on TV. But you've been helping boards think about this for a long time. Is real life Succession as exciting or as crazy as it's portrayed on this HBO TV show?
You know, it's funny. You're actually touching a real sensitive chord here. We have one of the top selling books in the world on the topic of Succession. It's called Who. It's a book on hiring, but specifically in the context of Succession. So my wife won a charity auction thing a year ago to be able to put our Who book in a product placement in any show we want. And so we had the producers at Succession, this agency that was like a fundraiser for this not-for-profit, was trying to convince them to do a product placement for our book. And I even offered to be on set as a Succession expert because, you know what, as fun as the show is, and we love it, we haven't missed a minute of it. The business speak around the deals and the merger and acquisition stuff rings true. Like it sounds about right, doesn't it? Because they have real M&A people on set giving them advice. They don't have any Succession people on set, as far as I could tell, because you know there's just not a lot of method to the madness, the way that Logan Roy is determining his successors. And he should be met with the same degree of failure that other closely held businesses that go on personality and gut feel and what the latest jokes are people are telling or what someone says at dinner on a Thursday, you know, as evidence for someone's competence to be able to take on a business empire.
So how should Succession actually unfold? So if you're a big, you know, top 10 or any, you know, Fortune 500 company that's thinking about how to develop the next CEO, like what's the right way for a board of directors to pick the next CEO?
So corporate CEOs, you know, last only a couple of years on average. So, you know, even the beginning of a current person's term is a race against the clock. But yeah, textbook would say you get on board with the board on what the anticipated basic strategy of the company is over the next, you know, call it 5 years or so. You translate that strategy of the company into a set of criteria then that you use to evaluate existing candidates for succession and develop them individually or as a group. And then you look at candidates that the search firms, the fine ones that you've worked with previously, will go survey the market and say, hey, you know what? You know, Meg Whitman might be gettable and she's amazing. You know, let's evaluate her against the scorecard also. So basically it starts with a scorecard where you lay out the criteria and then and just basically a lot of hard work of interviewing people and developing internal candidates and interviewing people and having a point of view on external candidates. Then comes the selection part where you actually decide. And those are intense meetings where there's a lot of data hopefully being thrown around to support gut feelings about who is ready or not ready to be a CEO of a big company. And then there's the onboarding period where the new person is doing a listening tour and you're, you know, helping them really get a handle on their existing team and think about the next generation of talent. So that whole thing, you know, it's a lot of work, but a lot of precise work and data collection yields a 90% success rate. 90% is pretty good. That's very high. Mm-hmm. The lack of all the work I just mentioned and, you know, going on gut feel or political maneuvering or other less effective methods has a sub 50% chance of success.
Wow. So that's a huge difference. And just to play devil's advocate, you know, sure. the world is changing so fast right now. And, you know, you're always hit with a new competitor or some sort of, you know, political change or an exogenous factor. How can you evaluate a strategy 5 years in advance? You know, what happens if the strategy changes like in year one or 6 months later?
You made me remember a fashion industry board meeting, a fashion company. They make clothing and market it globally. And the 10-person board was anticipating what the strategy of their company would be over the coming just 3 years because we were deep into a CEO succession. And it was funny because I had two colleagues there and then the 10 board members. And the boards always assume the strategy is kind of obvious or, you know, don't ask me about that. It's pretty clear we're all on the same page. It's like, well, wait a second, because I was kind of bringing up your point. Like, hey, look, in this case, the fast industry changing rapidly, where stuff's being made, how stuff's being sold, digital marketing, you know, all this stuff, right? Technology. And we were asking simple questions like, to what extent are some of these things likely to be a part of or not a part of the strategy? And it was amazing just watching them argue and debate with each other But the adult, like, responsible thing to do is to put some stakes in the ground. And you could even say something like, hey, look, we are considering one of two strategies of 50 strategies. So let's find candidates who might be good for strategy one or strategy two. I think that's fine. But to have no regard for what values and skills and experiences might be useful in the new chapter of the career, I think it's just, you know, like malpractice on the part of many boards. Yes.
Do you think that most boards, from your experience, because you've been in so many boardrooms, you know, helping them think through these crazy succession issues, like, do you think the composition of the board directors are correct, or do you think that they still need to evolve somewhat? Because, you know, I still think of some of these folks as a little bit conservative in their thinking, more steeped in past tradition rather than, you know, really intellectually curious and wanting to learn, you know, and deal with these curveballs that are thrown at them constantly. What is your experience?
Our experience, I would say, and this is most of what hopefully I'll reveal in this podcast or what we write about in our books is based on big research. We have, we've gathered data on over 30,000 successful and unsuccessful executive careers from doing all these assessments. We've, you know, poached tens of thousands of people. So we, you know, lots of data. And then we often partner with professors at top universities to analyze it and then actually find, you know, we have these objective third parties who then tell us, you know, what's in the data, and then we write books about it. So a lot of what I share with you is data driven when it's not. And this question, we don't have data. So I like the question, so I'm happy to give you an answer. My impressions are,
I know you're going to hate the way I frame this, Jeff, but what's your gut feel tell you on that?
Yeah, no, it's fine. We can gut feel on talking about, you know, the theory of board success, but just not on, you know, actually making a selection decision for a key executive. I'd say when I founded the company 28 years ago, boards were mostly a rubber stamp, just sort of like going through the motions, Sarbanes-Oxley or not, and not really providing much leadership or work. Today, I'd say a full quarter of boards, so not by any means over half, and these are private equity boards or public boards, are value-added entities where people hustle. You have different specialties. You see younger people on boards. So you have Gen Z, Gen Y, you know, kind of younger folks, and their voices represented. You see folks from much, you know, variety of backgrounds, especially historically up underrepresented folks are showing up, you know, in much better representation in, well, like a third or so of the boards today. Gender equality getting very close in half the board today, you know, so lots of, I guess, good progress in diversity of, you know, age and gender, ethnicity, et cetera, and that kind of thing. But mostly, I think that the improvements in the board I've seen in the last 5 years versus 25 years ago are they want to problem solve, they want data, they want to be a force for good as opposed to a passive rubber stamp entity. So you do see boards saying things like, hey, look, we've got some real work to do here. We have some, you know, disruptive technologies that are coming to eat our lunch. You know, we need to hustle and put a new strategy together and make sure, here's the new part too, that the talent in the company aligns to the new strategy. That language is very rare, you know, 20, 15 years ago, not very rare today. You see nom and gov committees, you know, are responsible for talent and culture related topics, which is great to see. That was more of an anomaly, you know, a couple decades ago. It's more common today to have a point of view as a board on the talent, on the org chart, on the culture of the business. You know, you take, I don't mean to pick on a non-client like Wells Fargo, but where you have, you know, just a few years ago, like a really bad problem where they encountered the company had some culture mistakes where they signed up a bunch of accounts and, you know, got more than a slap on the wrist for fraud, you know, et cetera. All that stuff, if you're just, you know, rubber stamping financials and not speaking up in board meetings, that's on you, board. I mean, so yes, culture, yes, hiring, yes, success. And I think boards today take a lot more responsibility for not just the what, but the how and the who of the organization.
And does a board, the way that they act and the way that they carry themselves, you know, behind closed boardroom doors, does that somehow set the culture for the entire organization if it happens in the boardroom, especially, you know, it's considering the CEO is there too?
I think the answer is yes. And so that's very empowering for a board. So I went to a you were a fellow at HBS. We love HBS. HBS wrote a couple cases on my firm as a pioneer in this talent space, which is lovely. They're writing another case right now on our we have kind of a weird freedom culture internally at DH Smart, a very, very free culture that's very modern and very distributed, geographically. They're writing a case on. But is that
who's writing that case? Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, so Ashley Willens. She studies time, money, and happiness in the workplace.
So I mean, cool.
What's more important than time, money, and happiness? And so she was very fascinated with our culture where we give people a lot of control and freedom in the culture. We could talk more about culture in a second if you want. It's allowed us to win some of those awards that you mentioned.
And we had another guest, David Teese, that's a professor at Berkeley on the show, and has the same philosophy, gives a lot of autonomy, empowers his talent, and basically he used to say, you can eat what you kill. I don't know if that's in vogue anymore, but he has grown twice now, the fastest growing consulting firms in the country. And I love the philosophy, but you don't see much of it. And I don't know why.
Yeah, it's kind of weird. I don't know about you, but growing up, when I was thinking about what I wanted to be when I grew up, you look at becoming a doctor and the grueling hours of going to med school and being a fellow and the residency, all that, that's pretty rough. Being a top lawyer, grueling, investment banking, finance, grueling, grueling, big three strategy, consulting, grueling. And I think in this day and age, with technology and changing people's preferences, you don't have to have a grueling culture to have high performance organizations. So we have, at DH Smart, we really flip on its head a lot of the assumptions that I think traditional firms have. Like, you need to closely manage people, and kind of like your friend, our attitude is, no, you don't. If you hire well, hire well. If you hire well, right, and you're aligned on values and you have a lot of trust and confidence in your colleagues' capabilities, I mean, getting the heck out of the way is more of an approach that leads to innovation and happiness in the workplace than excessive micromanagement. Also, I think a tough part is a lot of companies struggle to connect the reward people experience monetarily and otherwise with results. But if you really say, hey, look, let's be clear on what the expectations are here, both values-wise as well as results, and you're going to get compensated based on performance, not on politics, that's another hint for how I think you could have a much more free market sort of culture that works, that is coordinated, that actually produces great value for customers.
And I bet people are, from graduates to business school to undergraduates to experienced hires are pounding down your door because they want that kind of culture.
Well, sure. I mean, you mentioned a couple of, Vault is our industry rating agency, right, for consulting firms. And when I started at GH Smart, I was really looking up to the best firms in consulting, although we're in a niche, but we get looped, lumped in with the big firms. But yeah, we did beat Bain, McKinsey, and BCG in most selective firm this last year for 2023. Highest compensation, client interaction, work-life balance, hours in the office, like few hours in the office.
Happiness?
Happiness, overall satisfaction. GH Smart, number one. Those firms, I think Bain was stupid.
How does that make you feel?
I started this firm and Peter Drucker said that was crazy. But half the reason I started it was I really wanted a place for, I wanted to work at a place I wanted to work at. And you've heard a lot of founders say that. I wanted to build a shoe, I wanted to wear, I wanted to, that kind of thing. I wanted to be a customer of the place. But I didn't feel like lining up, on Wall Street with a, bunch of folks kind of marching off in lockstep into the grinder. I wanted to create a culture where people could do very impactful work every day, very, very meaningful work, get compensated for it, have great colleagues, and also have a life outside of work. That's it. Also, I think I see it. Like, I started GH Smart right as the cell phone became, in 1995, accepted business practice, emails. I mean, we had an advantage in that we didn't have any money, right? So we didn't have fancy offices. We didn't force people to drive 90 minutes from Greenwich, Connecticut into downtown Manhattan to go to work. Like, we literally by necessity had a distributed work environment. Today, we're still 100% virtual. We have 180 of us in 5 countries. It works great. The same principles and culture still apply. And yeah, people want to come here if they want to do meaningful work, have more freedom, have a life, and, you know, make good impact and compensation without that sacrifice feeling where you always feel guilty that you're not being a good, you know, parent or friend or, you know, member of your community.
What were some of the biggest challenges you faced as you were growing GH Smart? Maybe like a big setback, you know, that things didn't go the way you thought. And how did you feel in that experience? And what did you learn?
Sure. Once we got good at what we were doing, this is probably 10 years into our nearly 30-year history, I think we got a little bit smug and a little bit like we have all the answers. And one project in particular, I remember we patted ourselves on the back for figuring out part of a problem of a leadership team that was getting invested in by some major global players. But we sort of stopped short. We allowed ourselves to get a little busy. And so we moved on kind of the next project. And there was more to uncover in this particular project. And our clients ended up losing all of their investment.
Wow.
In the deal. We wow. refunded back their fee because I felt horrible. Oh my gosh, like it was a horrible thing. We guarantee our clients are happy with the work or we give them their money back. And that's just because I was a young founder and got going, I was afraid, you know, I was terrified about making clients unhappy. So we really aligned their interests with our interests. So, you know, they got their money back on it, but we didn't refund them back the, you know, couple $100 million
equity. Yeah, it was a drop in the bucket.
Right. So I felt horrible about that. That was basically getting too busy and not, you know, really paying attention to the full answer. I think there's a Bob Kagan, or Kagan is it, the Harvard prof, came and did a thing where he helped us identify, this is great, assumptions we were making that were holding us back.
What were they?
Yeah, so the one big one was, and he announced this sort of halfway through a day-long strategy session with our team. This is not too long after founding, but, you know, we weren't scaling or bigger by any means. We're still really finding our way. He said, you know what? You know, I got to just end the conversation right here. I think I've figured out the assumptions you're making that are holding you back here. And we said, what's that? And he said, I think the big assumption you're making internally at GH Smart is if you hire the best, they no longer need to learn and develop.
Huh.
So I grew up in the, you know, the learning organization, the fifth discipline by, I forgot who the author was, like with a big book.
Sankey or something.
Sankey, yeah, Peter yeah. Sankey, exactly. Thank you. So, hey, the discipline of learning is important. And because, as you pointed out earlier, you know, the world is changing very fast. So your ability to learn, it's a teachable skill. It's a learnable skill. There are tricks you have. There are tricks I have as, you know, team leaders for how we can learn. But basically, I really missed it early on. I got the hiring part right. Like, hey, let's hire the best. And we really, from the very beginning, had unbelievable people come here and take care of clients from day one. But they felt they weren't getting the support. They felt like we're kind of pioneering an industry here and we didn't have good disciplines around innovation and learning and a culture where it's okay to make a mistake and talk about it. So that was a kind of a young learning curve mistake that I was making as the founder and then CEO of the business.
And how did you fix that? And I wonder if you have completely fixed it because there isn't that common space, you know, physical space that they come into every day. So how do you keep such incredibly talented superstars that are geographically dispersed, you know, somehow connected and innovating?
I really appreciate the question. I don't know that I have a satisfying answer on how we maintain a great culture being geographically spread out. The evidence, you could like read on Glassdoor, which is useful actually. I click open our Glassdoor weekly and look and see if there are new comments about the culture and what's good or what could be better and that kind of thing. We do have a 4.8 out of 5, which is the highest score anybody in consulting, finance, or technology has of the top firms. So, like, people really
4.8 on what? Overall? Or
4.8 out of 5 overall rating, 100% approval of moi.
So you're doing something right. Crack the code.
So, how in the world, you know, like, first of all, how do we get that final point too? Because, like, you know, we're obsessed with perfection. But honestly, here's the deal.
That's the Peter Drucker in you coming out.
Peter Drucker. Well, you know, he did coin the term culture eats strategy for breakfast. So, Jeffrey, I'm not kidding. I spend 30 40% of my time as founder, I'm just chairman and founder. I don't run the firm day to day these days. We have a whole management team. We have a great president. We have 19 partners. Like they really do run the firm and they do a great job at it. But I spend most of my time on culture crafting. Like I really do in my heart believe if you craft the right culture, you can attract the right talent and hang on to them. What they'll tell you is we do get together in person. We're going to be, you and I are close to each other here in Colorado. We'll be up in Beaver Creek in a month as a whole firm. Everybody. Also, everybody gets to own stock in GH Smart. Oh, that's cool. A little bit unusual. You're a new administrative assistant. Guess what? You care about how much money we're spending on the summit because it comes out of your quarterly distributions. I mean, having everyone be an owner, being geographically distributed, but still investing the time and money to get together. Client teams get together and mentor each other and learn and that kind of thing. Different industry subsections of the firm do meet in person. We do a lot of work though, you know, on Zoom or on our phones or on emails, or we have, you know, knowledge sharing. We're very sharing oriented. Generosity and gratitude, that's one value we have that we select people on. So if you come here and you hoard information and you're not friendly, the system kind of spits you out. But if you come here and you're generous and you're sharing and you're advising and you're mentoring people and you know everyone says please and thank you, those are some of the elements for how we stitch this culture together.
But Jeff, I get the sense just from reading some of the articles that you and your colleagues have written that you guys really have a hunger, you know, an intellectual curiosity to solve and to think about and to really chew on tough issues. I mean, is that something that keeps people somewhat connected as well?
I think so. It's kind of like those military units that where it's like nearly impossible to get in, and it's a real painful process to get selected in. And then you know, then you're in, and you have this sort of shared experience that you're working on hard, meaningful things. You remember the book Flow from the 80s?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, great book. His name was, I got this name, Mahali Csikszentmihalyi. Uh-huh. Here it is. And he was a professor also with Peter Drucker at Claremont, where I went. So this book, and for those of you listening, I'm showing Jeffrey. So he has a great quote in here that hits the point that you just made. He said, contrary to what we typically believe, the best times in life are not the relaxing times. The best times in life are those when our minds and bodies are stretched to their limit in the pursuit of a goal that is difficult but worthwhile.
Mm, wow. All right. So let's take that quote. Like, how do you then assess whether or not somebody has that, you know, very intangible quality that you know is going to be important, not only for GH Smart, but for your clients' organizations too, I assume.
Sure. You bet. Hey, you know what? I'd like to give you props for an amazing segue. I'm bringing out my best, most powerful quotes, and you absorbed it and you steered me in a cool new direction, which is like, hey, how do you figure out if someone has you know, that type of potential. Okay, so this is great. This is really important. This is a super long conversation, so I'll try to be very brief. How do you spot potential in people? And how do you know if they're likely to fit a culture or not? Step one is putting some words on what's your culture. And we've done this exercise with the biggest companies in the whole world and teeny tiny startups and some other, you know, a bunch in between, where we say, hey, look, we can't help you pick the right CEO or C-suite folks without codifying, you know, what's the culture or what's the desired culture. And you want to put stuff in there that is legitimate and useful, not just like clonism. So what you don't want to do is be like this 1990s Chicago-based commodities trading firm that will remain nameless, like no one knows what it is, small firm. I refuse to do business with them because they said they only wanted to hire hockey players. And I said, I'm like, first of all, I'm not good at hockey. I mean, but aren't we ignoring, you know, half the population because, you know, men play hockey, women generally don't play competitive hockey in the same ratios and like talk about lack of diversity, et cetera. So I was like, hey, let's unpack that. Why don't we talk about let's hire aggressive, team-oriented people, right? That includes everyone. They're like, no, we want to hire hockey players. So one way not to find good folks that fit your culture is to use, you know, clonism, bias, cronyism, shorthand like that excludes most people on the planet. So that's bad.
But Jeff, don't most companies like have very generic, you know, leadership competencies and values or not? I mean, are they more specific?
Yeah, no.
I tell you, you can line up 10 companies and sometimes I'll be able to tell you which companies which just looking at their values or leadership competencies.
I think that's right. And honestly, we don't do a lot of work to help companies crystallize their actual values and leadership competencies. We do a quick and dirty version, but it's very authentic. So, and here's some things that should resonate with you. Some companies really like fast decision making, you know, kind of like Facebook Meta's like move fast and break thing, right? That's a very, very, very different culture than the opposite end, where it's like, no, we're methodical, we're a science-based engineering firm, we have, you know, high CapEx expenditures, we have a very long time horizon, we're not going to make fast decisions, we're going to make the right decisions. So, you know, there's a teamwork thing. There's one client, and this is going to get at a question I think you're going to ask me later, if I'm guessing where you're going with, like, how coachable are people who don't quite fit the culture to coach them or not.
For sure.
The answer is, like, you better be pretty sure you know how match or unmatch someone is for culture. We had a leading private equity titan who wanted to hire someone to one of the biggest private equity funds in the world, but this fund had a culture they wanted of being like the nice people in private equity and being collaborative and team oriented. The candidate was a heads down solo operator, rough around the edges, didn't play nice in the sandbox. And we said, hey, look, we respect you, we respect this candidate. There's no match here. So there's not a match. And the client on the private equity firm that wanted to be the nice people in private equity said, well, can't you just coach this person? And in fact, they offered us $1 million coaching fee because this person was such a big rainmaker, sourcer of deals, deployer. They really wanted to find a reason to hire this person who was a bad culture match. And we stuck to our guns and we said no. So to answer your question on culture picking, you can, once you've defined the culture you're looking for, is it teamwork or is it independent solo? They're mutually exclusive. You can't have both. Like, either we're a big team place or a bunch of, you know, individual contributors. Like, so anyway, in this particular case, identify the culture, one. Two is really do in-depth work to understand a person for who they really are. Mm-hmm. What in every job they've had did they accomplish? What mistakes do they make? Who do they work with by name? What are those people saying about them in references? Are their biggest strengths and weaknesses and work styles? If you have all that data, it is not difficult to identify what someone's sort of natural work style is relative to the culture that you just defined. But it's through data and hard work that you're able to make that surgical fit determination, not through gut feel and bias.
And what about potential? How do you tell if this same private equity firm or a different client, you know, see somebody they really like and they've been great at all the things that they've done before? How do you know if that person has the leadership potential to actually rise up within the hiring organization and achieve great things, maybe even become the CEO one day?
We have a huge line of research on that culminated in a New York Times best-selling book that my firm published. My name's not on the byline, but our company is, called The CEO Next Door. This is a great book. I love it. My colleagues, Elena and Tim, wrote it based on a breakthrough study of over 2,600 leaders. So we very, very, very methodically looked at people and to try to spot their potential. And Elena and Tim and the professors at Columbia and University of Chicago who did the number crunching. Steve Kaplan at the University of Chicago. Is a
great guy.
Phenomenal professor, and Mort Sorensen, one of his old PhD students who worked on our Who book stuff, is now all grown up and teaching at Columbia. So they crunched the data on this one, and we spotted four things that just empirically predicted someone's likelihood to get to the C-suite and succeed in it. And I'll tell you what they are.
I want to know. Our listeners want to know, man.
Yeah. All right. Here we go. So it spells DARE. And this is it. So literally, this, you know, thousands of cases. And the question is literally, what did you spot about these people that was consistent relative to the people who fell off to the side and kind of didn't, you know, make it to the C-suite? And D stands for decisiveness. So we found a very strong, statistical effect that people who take more decision risk, make decisions faster. But like, their attitude was like, if I make a bad decision, I'll make another one to sort of fix it. But forward progress, decision speed, huge predictor of C-suite potential. One. Number two, A stands for adaptability. So folks who, you know, grew up in an, you know, underprivileged school, but I talked my way into, you know, going to this boarding school, and then I moved abroad, and I did people with like varied experiences, you know, international, global experience, people who are able to join new organizations and say, what does it take to succeed here? Kind of the opposite of the negative version of that, which Marshall Goldsmith writes Bridget. About in What Got You Here Won't Get You There. Like the people who like just repeat their same patterns, no matter what the situation, you know, find a situation sometimes where it doesn't work and they fail. People who are adaptable. So
being very rigid, I would think, would be.
That's right. Yeah. Being rigid or their communication style. But the folks who made it through our screens, who made it up to the C-suite, were very, very adaptable, where they asked the question, what does it take to be successful in this new situation?
And that doesn't mean, Jeff, that they're wishy-washy or they go back and forth on
No, it means it's kind of like they have a humble enough approach where they say, hey, I might have been successful in a, you know, growth-oriented industrial business. Now I'm in a more brand-oriented media company. It's different. Like what's going to take to be successful is different. So recognizing they're playing a different game and adapting is number two of four. Number three is R, which is I can't remember. One of us wrote an article on this is the most boring of the four keys to success as a CEO is reliability. Doesn't that sound boring?
Boring, but rare.
Rare. If you are reliably setting goals, achieving them, you know, against all odds, people can count on you to do what you say you're going to do and achieve the results that you commit to. That's a huge predictor of success in the C-suite.
So Jeff, you're going to think I'm a pain in the butt, but does that on the flip side mean that somebody is consistently not setting ambitious enough goals if they're always hitting them?
Maybe. Yeah, it's funny. One of our other findings is you can have a couple of career flops and still make it to the C-suite. So it doesn't mean you have to be perfect or sandbag your goal, but the group of the reliables versus the less reliables, you know, you and I from a 10 feet away could tell the difference. It's basically people who don't take commitments seriously or the unreliables, both on, you know, hard results as well as values and integrity and like all that kind of stuff. Folks who take commitments very seriously and the idea of service and the idea of really being there for your team and your customers, you know, it's a different like work ethic. And those folks, you know, outperformed others and made it to the C-suite in much higher percentages.
Love it. Then E?
Ooh, yeah. E is engaging for impact. So this one's about being persuasive, I think. So this one's about not being the know-it-all with the right answer, you know, not being the prickly authoritarian leader who's going to bark orders. You know, not in this day and age. Like this day and age, and our data set is very current. The leaders who are able to empathize, E doesn't stand for empathy, but it could, you know, empathize, really meet you where you are, whether it's talking to more junior level colleagues or senior colleagues or customers or shareholders or anybody. But that the two different buckets, the folks who had low engaging for impact, you know, really were kind of like stuck in their own heads and we're just sort of driving forward. The folks with a high engaging for impact are willing to listen first and speak second. Really, you know, not I was gonna say Dale Carnegie, it's not Dale Carnegie, it's the Covey 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. First, seek to understand before seeking to be understood. Those kind of leaders way outperformed the talk first, you know, take no prisoners type.
I love this model. And, you know, to me, like the engagement, I see a lot of empathy in that. The reliability, I see a lot of integrity and character. But this sort of leads me to my next question. What's more important, you know, soft skills or hard skills?
So let's think about this for a second. Soft skills is the answer, but let's see if we can, you know, provide.
And I didn't expect you to say that.
Really? It's funny. We found in some Steve Kaplan research for our WHO book, we called it the cheetah or the lamb, which was, there was a type of CEO that was very decisive. This preceded the research I just told you about on the CEO next door. CEOs acted like cheetahs, fast moving, decisive, you know, very concerned about results. Like there's even a cool graphic here. There's a cheetah and there's a lamb. The lamb is like kind of awestruck, very, a little more level five, kind of like Jim Collins' research, which I think only contrasted 20 companies. So, you know, we had 15,000, right, versus 20. So I'm not saying one's better research. I think Jim Collins' Good to Great is a phenomenal book, but we did look at thousands more examples and compared the two. And we found, at least as it relates to achieving financial targets, the fast moving, decisive, more aggressive style was associated with higher returns and financial performance. That said, what they were leveraging was not finance skills or engineering or hard skills the way you framed it, but it's the softer skills of being fast to make decisions and being kind of inspirational and forward moving and willing to make hard decisions like this. Is it a hard skill or a soft skill if you're more likely to hire and fire to build a team quicker? I think that's a soft skill, right? Hiring is kind of a soft skill, but it's soft skills with like a little bit of a hard edge. I think it's like the profile that had the higher financial performance.
I almost think of it as you're describing it, like the soft skills like empathy and good judgment and integrity are almost the foundational skills that enable someone to make, you know, to be the hard edge cheetah.
I think there's a lot of truth to that. And we looked at, here's a finding on that front. What percentage of leaders are honest? And this, the part that this flies in the face of is, I think there are a lot of leadership lessons around trust and honesty and integrity being so important. Well, of course they're important, but they're not that rare. So so we found, I'm just looking for the number here because I want to give you an accurate number.
So it doesn't really differentiate so much.
That's right. It's like having lungs. Like, yeah, I mean, having lungs is pretty important, but it's not very rare. That's all. 91% of the leaders in our, at this point, I think our database had 12,000 exec failed and succeeded to successful executives in it. 91% of them cleared a very high bar of integrity. So, you know, 9% of folks out there are, you know, not high integrity people, but 91% are high integrity. Therefore, it's not like something that should be a big deal that you're constantly sorting people on just because it's not that rare a skill. The rarer skills, 14% of leaders are good at hiring, 24% of leaders are good at prioritizing strategies, and 47% of leaders we found are good at building relationships. But if you put those three things together, it's spelled power. The P is prioritization. W is who, meaning like hiring and firing to get the who part right, and relationship. We found, this is going to knock the socks off, I hope, leaders of teams where the leader was good at all three, prioritizing, hiring and firing, and building relationships, were 20 times more likely to achieve their financial target than if you're weak at any one of the three. So it had a multiplicative property where it's not like you could be good at this, plus this. It's more like this, times this yields your probability as a leader in achieving success with your team. And are those soft skills or hard skills? They're mostly soft skills. You know, it's mostly around prioritizing to me is around making good decisions. That's a little bit of a soft skill. Hiring certainly is a softest skill, and then, you know, building relationships, again, a little bit more of a soft skill. But those are the three magic things that if you put them together, you know, predict success.
How much of these things, if, you know, there's a rising star leader that is missing one of these things, how much of that is coachable? I mean, you mentioned earlier that one of these private equity firms offered you $1 million to come in and try to coach somebody. Like, can you coach these things, or which ones are more or less coachable?
I think it's a wise question. What's more or less coachable? This power framework that the TW and R has described, all three of those things are very coachable. So you can coach and train people how to become better at prioritizing strategies, hiring disciplines. You know, as well as I do, there's, you know, best practices you can teach people. They can learn how to hire better and make fewer mistakes. And then on relationships, there's all sorts of parts of relationship management you can get better at. Our general approach is people should constantly be trying to work on the things that either they're lacking or they're particularly good at, but they want to become excellent at it around those categories. The things that are proven not by us, but by the field of industrial psychology to be less coachable are your natural just brain. So your brains, your IQ test scores, like it's very hard just, you know, to want someone to be a lot faster of a processor of information that creativity, some people say is learned. That's not my experience. Having assessed and coached a lot of people, you do have creative that are different folks from, you know, more linear thinkers. So there's some of these really character deep, integrity, creativity, core brain power areas that aren't super coachable, as you know, other psychological studies have shown. But a lot of the things that are important for success, all the DARE things and the P, the W, and the R, all coachable. All coachable.
I love it. And speaking of coaching, we had a former NBA coach on, Stan Van Gundy, on a recent show. And he, of course, talked about teamwork. And his job is really hard because he has to get a bunch of these superstars, you know, to work and gel as an effective team. What is an effective team, you know, through your lens of 20 years of doing this with top companies? And how should a leader go about, you know, creating and managing great teams?
Good question. I love it. What comes up for me is the 1982 gold medal winning U.S. hockey team.
Hockey.
Oh no, back
hockey.
To the hockey. Back to the
I'm
hockey.
I'm starting there. To see a theme here.
Yeah, there's hockey. A theme there. That was unintentional, but like Freud would have a field day with this. But in that, the coach famously said, "I'm not recruiting the best players. I'm recruiting the right players for this team." That was very controversial and uncommon thinking back then. Today it's not uncommon. And I think, I don't know, you and I could riff on the reasons why viewing a team as a, you know, a set of role players, different roles, different skill sets to make a good team. The world is so atomic these days. I think skill sets and expertises are getting narrower and deeper. You know, like, I mean, you could even double click on a marketing person today. Oh, really? A marketing person. Okay. Are we talking business development or branding? Are we talking PR or something else? Oh, we're talking website development. Okay. Website development. Are we talking about copy? Or are we talking about design? Are we, you know, it's like you can go crazy.
You do the same thing at hospitals and it drives you crazy because you end up going to 20 different doctors that are all specialists.
That's right.
And they don't collaborate with each other.
That's right. Well, lots of challenges. Well, you just put your finger on something. If you're assembling a team of specialists, and there are legitimately different specialized skill sets you need people to cover, you know, how do you hire for them properly? And then how do you get them all communicating and working together as a team, I think is the business challenge of the day. And I mean, I could give a short answer on the selection part. Really just comes back to making sure you're defining those roles pretty carefully and finding someone who's excellent at that. Now, I coach a lot of younger emerging entrepreneurs who I don't know why, but so many of them are telling me, you know, oh yeah, my cousin or my roommate is like wearing five hats in our new startup, you know, very broad designs of the jobs and very generic role players are playing them. And I try to get those entrepreneurs to think, okay, let's blank sheet of paper this for a second. You're at the stage where your product's ready for market and you need some real sales animals to get out there and sell it. So rather than have your roommate from a couple of apartments ago playing five roles, one of which is head of sales, let's hire a really amazing salesperson, you know, and then she can get out there and ring the cash register. Like, so hiring the specialist, defining roles more narrowly and hiring people who demonstrate competence in those areas, that's most of the challenge. Getting really great people to work well together, I think it's an easier challenge if you get the selection step right.
All right. So what about, so Mark Cuban was another guest, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, Shark Tank.
Love Mark Cuban.
And he said, you know, Jeff, in the NBA, it comes down just to talent. That's by far the most important thing.
Oh, mic drop.
And so then recently, you know, he acquired Kyrie Irving. And I actually emailed him. I said, I don't think it's going to work. And then I wrote an article. I said, I don't think it's going to work. And guess what? It's not working. And so what do you, like, how would you counter his statement of it's all about talent?
You know, did a great job with the turnaround of Ford.
Mullally.
His name will come to me. And it, yeah, Mullally. Yes. Showed up, and this is a well-researched, this is just common knowledge. He's not a client, so I could talk about it because it's just stuff I've heard. And we don't talk about clients, of course. People wasn't a client, isn't a client. But I really respect that he came into the first few meetings with Ford and said, hey, everybody, show me your goals and actuals. And I want to see reds, greens, and yellows. If your green is good, yellows on the border and red bet. And everybody had green, as far as the eye can see. And he kind of sat there and said, look, we are failing. We are losing, you know, $3 billion a quarter here. and I see nothing but a sea of green. I need you to trust me and trust each other that we are going to identify problems and we're going to solve them together. You are not alone. Hmm. And he quit the meeting. The meeting was like a 2-hour meeting. They quit it in like 10 minutes because like everyone is just acting like everything is great in their departments and divisions. Next meeting, the next week, you know, smatterings of yellows and some reds with the green. And he demonstrated, this is a great leadership moment where it's like, hey, look, truth, we all have to trust each other and get the truth on the table, because if we can see it, we can fix it. And he did a really impressive turnaround of that organization in a short period of time by really taking some very talented people and taking off the old habits of hiding the truth and instead taking a, you know, forward-leaning, action-oriented, let's identify problems and solve them together approach. And really, not a whole lot else changed. It was just, you know, that style of bringing these superstars together to trust each other, focus on results, and be helpful.
So I have about 20 more questions, but I know we're out of time. It's like the fastest hour of my week.
Me too. It's so fun.
But a quick question. What is your future? Like, what is the future of Jeff Smart, and what is the future of GH Smart?
Well, I'm still unemployable, Jeff, because I've never had a real job. So I'm chairman and founder of this place. So my future and the firm's future are pretty closely linked. I'm 50, so I'm not 80 years old. There's not, you know, we don't need a chair, founder and chair success anytime soon. So I really love my job. I get to meet very interesting colleagues who join. We're in the US, UK, Germany, Canada, and we're opening our first office in the Asia Pacific region later this year. Yeah, phenomenal people. So it's really fun helping recruit and shape culture and talent.
What is your pitch to new recruits?
I mean, new recruits is basically, the pitch is, this isn't for everybody. If you like impact, you like the key thing is that they like the challenge of leadership. Like, we exist to help leaders amplify their positive impact on the world. That's the credo of the firm. So if people are real high performers out of professional services and they like the people part of business, then they might be interested in joining our firm.
In your future, you're going to stay with the firm and continue to do rainmaking and thought leadership and building the culture.
Yes, that's right. And I have a bunch of kids where my wife had 3 kids when I married her 6 years ago. I had 4. We made twins together. So I have 9 kids.
Oh my God.
So making time for family. A couple of them are, you know, out of the house in college, but we have 7 in the house.
I have 1 and I feel like it's a full-time job.
No. I'm very proud of being a family person. And I think it sets a good example for our colleagues and our clients too. But yeah, I prioritize family. So between family and helping raise the remaining 7 kids, you know, successfully out of the house, being a great husband and friend and, you know, active in the community, you know, between that on the personal side and all the fun I get to do on the professional side, yeah, I think I'm going to do more of the same, you know, for the coming years. I'd like to serve on some big corporate boards one day. I think that'd be interesting. I'd love to play a value added role as a talent person on a large corporate board. That'd be kind of a bucket list future thing.
Jeff Smart, thank you so much. I literally could talk to you for 3 more hours, but this is very generous of you. I very much enjoyed this.
You're a skilled interviewer. Jeff, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening, everyone, and we hope you enjoyed today's conversation. If you'd like to attend and join deep dive discussions, please visit www.imperfectleaders.com. Until then, we'll see you next week.